Senate Committee on Business and Economic Development, meeting date Friday, March 18, 2005, at 10 a.m. at the River Valley High School. The chair is Senator Rick Metzger. Check one.
The Senate Committee on Business and Economic Development to order, and it is great to see everybody here. I want to have each member of the committee have an opportunity to introduce themselves and the area that they represent. So I'll start on my far right with Senator Lori Montes Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Senator Lori Montes Anderson, Senate District 25, which is Greshamwood Village, Troutdale, and Fairview. I'm a nurse by trade, but economic development is very important to my district, and I'm very honored to be a part of this committee. Glad to be here in Hood River.
Ms. Van Winkle.
I don't need to say anything. I'm Teresa Van Winkle. I'm the committee administrator for the committee.
And does a great job.
Thank you.
Senator Starr.
I'm Senator Bruce Starr. I represent Senate District 15, which is western Washington County, the communities of Hillsborough, Cornelius, North Plains, and Forest Grove. And it's great to be in beautiful Hood River.
Good morning. I am Ryan Deckert. I'm a state senator from Washington County, from Beaverton and Raleigh Hills and Alloa and a little bit of Southwest Portland. And the chair will tell you, you know, the last time we did a field hearing, they did a theatrical presentation of one of the bills. So we're now expecting, as we go out on the road, to have people, as they testify, do it in theatrical presentation. So we're on the edges of our seats up here.
You don't know what's behind the curtain. Okay, well, thank you very much, and we are very, very pleased to be here in Hood River, especially talking about issues today that I think are important to the people of this community and our rural community, especially when we talk about food processing, which is what we're going to start with now. So I'm going to open up a public hearing on Senate Bills 365 and 479. We're going to talk about these together, and I'm going to ask Mr. Ken Yates, Josh Reynolds, Mike and Bill Townsend, Jerry Gardner to come forward. And you can orchestrate this as you would like, but... Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Ken Yates. I'm Vice President of Government Affairs for the Northwest Food Processors Association. Our lobbyist, Rob Douglas, said that I look like I'm applying for a bank loan today, so that's as far as I'm going to get as far as a theatrical presentation. But thank you for the opportunity to testify on these two pieces of legislation. I wanted to start by giving you some positive and also some economic information of concern regarding the food processing industry, and then turn it over to some real people, real leaders in the industry who are struggling to compete in an increasingly competitive global environment and an increasingly consolidated customer market base, and also a situation where we have a great deal of overcapacity of production in the industry. First of all, food manufacturing is the third largest manufacturing employer in the state of Oregon, behind high-tech and wood products. It really is the third leg of the economic stool in Oregon and the Northwest. You take away that leg and the economy tips over. So it's high-tech, food products, and food manufacturing in terms of economic in manufacturing power in the state. We have been benchmarking the industry since 2001. Those numbers are in your packet. I refer you to the yellow sheet. For purpose of benchmarking, we emphasize or only benchmark those companies that have $1 million or more in sales or 20 or more FTEs. So when you look at these benchmarks, it's for the entire industry, not just the distressed sectors, and also for $1 million in sales or more, or 20 or more FTEs. As of 2005, March of this year, 179 companies process food, manufacture food in the state of Oregon. You can see the comparison to the other Northwest states. Of those, a number in the third box, most of those are, a great many of those are in the fruit, potato, and other vegetable, non-potato categories, about 65 altogether. You'll see that there are 33 fruit processors in the state, 4 potato processors, in 18 other vegetable, in addition to some other categories that the association represents. That is the, and then you go to the next page on the value added by the industry. It's difficult to estimate gross sales, so we do have a hard number on value added. The Oregon food manufacturing industry adds $1.87 billion this year. This is based on 2003 numbers, but about $1.87 billion in value to raw product. Annual payroll of just under $500 million and a total employment of nearly 17,000 folks. That's the good economic news. This has been a venerable and growth industry for almost 100 years in the state of Oregon and through the Northwest. But we've encountered some real difficulty in recent years, and I want to chat with you about that. Most disturbing has been a decline in total employment in the food manufacturing sector of 15.3% since 2001. Excuse me, between 2000 and 2003 is when last year's figures were available. So 15.3% decline in employment in the food sector, food manufacturing over that four-year period. During that same time, an 11% decline in payroll. Very similar numbers in Washington State. Contrast that with Idaho. You have a 4.1% decline during that same period in employment and an actual increase in payroll of 9.5% in terms of what's being paid to workers. And so we see a real competitive disadvantage emerging in Oregon and Washington. They're becoming increasingly high-cost places to do business by a number of measures. Traditional competitive advantages like low-cost energy, certain water supplies are being eroded and they need to be preserved. Some advantages still remain. It's an excellent growing climate, wonderful soil conditions. We have a top-notch workforce. The price of labor is becoming an increasing concern. Our industry pays well above the minimum wage, but when that minimum wage escalates annually on an index, that bumps up the entire wage ladder. You start at that floor and you negotiate up. That is becoming a real problem because we're competing against, the real competition is overseas, and we're competing against companies that pay in a day or even a week what we pay in an hour. And as we compete against China and South America, that is becoming an increasingly difficult competitive proposition. You'll be hearing more about that in a few minutes. We have also been tracking the number of plant closures in recent years. You have a green sheet, this list right here. In the last 5 years, a number of companies have closed their doors permanently. There's been a lot of churning and consolidation and sale and then resale of plants, particularly in the fruit and vegetable sector. This is just the fruit and vegetable list, which is the hardest hit sector in the new global environment. These are folks who are finding it increasingly difficult to compete globally, to compete in a consolidated customer marketplace. I have a food processor in Washington State, a name brand, that went from 23 customers to 5 customers in 2 years. They didn't lose any business. It simply consolidated. When you're in a consolidated environment like that, you end up with an overcapacity situation where you have too much production, too few customers, and those too few customers set the price for you. We don't set the price in the commodity food processing business. Value-added folks have a great deal more bargaining power, but when you're talking about fruit and vegetable, it's very difficult for those guys to get a price that covers their costs, and those costs are increasing. I'm working with the state economists in the employment division, the employment economists in the employment division, to give you a more comprehensive list and add to that layoff numbers. And so we hope to be updating that in the near future for you. Finally, I'll conclude my remarks with this study. We commissioned our economists to do an economic impact study on the recent closure of the J.R. Simplot facility in Hermiston, Oregon. I believe it's about 645 jobs that were lost there. This details, and there's an executive summary, this details the huge, huge economic dislocation and negative economic impacts in that community and for the state. The purpose of the legislation before you is to give the industry some cost relief so they can compete better in a global environment, in a consolidated customer environment, in an environment where there's an overcapacity of production because of a global economy. There are food manufacturing facilities sprouting up all over the world, and it is going to be a huge challenge. What we're really asking for, and this is just the first ask, this is the first step, in building a partnership at all levels of government and with higher education to build and enhance a competitive economic cluster that is able to compete globally and effectively in the United States as well. We'll be talking a lot more about that economic cluster. Hollywood is known for movies. Detroit is known for automobiles. This region has always been known for its value-added and its fresh food supply. And we want to keep that tradition going. We know we can do it. We know we can compete, but we need to partner with you in order to do that. We need some cost relief in order to invest in technology and in our workforce and in development and innovation of new products and the finding and identification of new market niches in order to compete effectively in this new global economy, because that's not going away, and we're not either. But we need to partner with state government, regional and federal agencies and institutions of higher learning in order to develop our workforce, make those technological investments, and find those niche markets for new and creative products. That concludes my testimony. I'd be happy to answer any questions regarding the bills themselves. I did have our legal counsel, our tax counsel, do some summaries for you, just one pagers, detailing what those pieces of legislation do. Essentially, this is cost relief for the struggling sectors of the industry. The first bill, Senate Bill 365, would be a state income tax credit for a percentage of gross seasonal labor costs. And again, I mentioned the increasing labor costs, particularly in the seasonal fruit and vegetable industry. The second bill, Senate Bill 479, is a state income tax credit for property taxes paid on machinery and equipment. And we see that as another economic stimulus tool to help the industry at a time when it's really struggling to find its foothold in a global economy. And with that, Mr. Chairman and members, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Reed. Thank you, Mr. Yates. I do have one question for you. I think you've laid out the situation well and kind of where we stand on this. I think you've also articulated the challenge, which is a very large one, in terms of the global economy. We certainly are familiar with that, not only in your industry and the processing industry, but at the origination stage as well. And certainly this valley faces those same challenges.
Absolutely.
My question would be is, regardless of whether we do this legislation or not, what is the the height of the bar? In other words, with the global challenges we face and the cost competitiveness that all of our folks face, even if we are to do this, is the challenge so great that we can't reverse that trend and bring food processing and really incent that industry so that it actually will grow here? Or are the obstacles so great that even if we do participate as a partner that it's still less expensive to do it elsewhere?
It's a very good question, Mr. Chairman. It is the central question, and there is no question in my mind that this industry can innovate and create new products and find those niches internationally and compete through the tools of technology and a skilled workforce in this global environment. I have no doubt about that in my mind. There is an innovation and creativity happening right now. I'll give you an example here in Oregon. There are several in Washington as well. The J.M. Smucker facility, after 40 years, closed in Woodburn. That facility was bought by Sabroso Company. Jim Root, you may be familiar with. He's the chairman of our legislative committee. He couldn't be here today. But he purchased that facility. They're doing value-added product. And some of it is grown locally, and other raw product supplies are secured overseas. They're doing milk cartons of pina colada mix in Woodburn, Oregon, and shipping those to customers throughout the United States and the world. So that kind of niche marketing and innovation is happening. There are a number of folks who just need some cost relief in order to make those investments. we want to partner with you. We know there's going to be an international piece to this in the trade sector. There's going to be a federal piece, and certainly we're going to have to work regionally in order to establish and enhance this regional economic cluster. It's been here. We need to preserve those competitive advantages we've always had, and we need to create new ones through technology and investment in our workforce and so forth.
Questions from the committee? Senator Mona Sanderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want you to review again the statements that you said. You said that employment has decreased in the food processing area. By how much? And you said the payroll has increased with what is left. Is that?
No, ma'am. I was referring to Idaho with the increase. In Oregon, employment has declined 15.3% between 2000 and 2003. Payroll, which is the dollar amount, has declined 11% during that same period. In Idaho, there was a small decline in employment and an increase, an actual increase in payroll. And what that tells me in Idaho is that there is a business environment that is supportive. There's a partnership that's in place. We're trying to make improvements to that partnership as well. And it's really going to have to be a regional and collaborative effort in the three states with the industry and among state governments in order to be effective.
Thank you.
Questions? Proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Josh Reynolds. I'm Vice President and General Manager of Gray & Company. Just a point of disclosure, I'm also a commissioner with the Oregon Sweet Cherry Commission. I'm testifying, however, on behalf of Gray & Company and my fellow colleagues in the sweet cherry industry, sweet cherry process industry, including Oregon cherry growers and Eola cherry. Collectively, these three processors, we probably represent about 80% of the processed sweet cherries in Oregon that are grown and produced in a value-added product. A little background on Gray & Company. We've been around since 1908. My family's had a vested interest in the business for the last 25 years. I am an owner of the business as well. I've been with it for about 8 years now. And our primary markets are maraschino cherries. We serve just about everybody in the United States, from Fred Meyer to Kroger to Western Family, up and down the board, including export markets. The maraschino cherry business has been relatively stable, and we rely heavily on the grape growers of Oregon, where we receive about 8 million pounds a year out of Oregon and another 8 million pounds out of Washington that we process in two facilities here in Oregon, one in Dayton and one in Forest Grove. I represent the second generation of management in this company, and there's a lot of debate within that management structure of where we should be operating. Here in Oregon, our costs are substantially higher than our other operating facility. We also maintain a plant in Michigan. And over the last 5 years, we've transferred more and more production from Oregon to Michigan. Why is that? Some simple cost, fundamental economics of the business. I'll give you a few examples. Hourly production, total wage and benefit in Michigan compared to Oregon, it's 9% higher here in Oregon. Corn syrup, one of our key ingredients, 17% higher, largely because it's produced in the Midwest and we have to ship it back here to Oregon. Glass, which is our primary packaging for maraschino cherries, is anywhere from 5 to 30% more expensive. Those are fundamental economics that are indeed difficult to overcome. Why are we still here? Why do we have a debate about every other week among my brother, who's also in the business, my father, our CFO, who's also an owner? We all love living in Oregon. I love living in Portland, raising my family here. We have a great success in recruiting people throughout the country to come work for us in Portland, our sales and marketing office, our administration, our executive office. We have a much harder time sustaining our business in Forest Grove in Oregon. As an example, about 6 years ago, our peak headcount in our Forest Grove facility was about 120. This last year, it peaked at 65, with an ongoing an average annual workforce of 60. We contribute right now about $6 million in total payroll in Oregon. And the writing is a little bit on the wall to simply pull up over time and move all of our operations to the Midwest in the face of, yes, international competition. For the first time, I saw a finished maraschino cherry product packed in China that showed up at the grocery outlet store in Hillsboro, Oregon. Yes, it's a little bit of a scary sight. I'm not concerned, though, fundamentally whether we can compete. I know we can. I know that our growers are motivated to stay in this business and to become more efficient. We certainly are at the manufacturing level, and again, I want to reiterate that I'm motivated to remain an Oregonian, be invested in this community, and have a little bit of relief over the time so we can develop other value-added products to sell to our key customers and develop new products, whether it's in the organic side of the business, other value-added ingredients, because we also participate in that. I want to remain committed to Oregon, and I appreciate your time this morning.
Thank you, Mr. Reynolds.
Questions? Mr. Reynolds. Yes, Senator
Montesano. Thank you, Mr. Chair. You chose Michigan, and I think Michigan has the lowest minimum wage in the United States. Could you tell me what that minimum wage is and what ours is now?
I believe the minimum wage is the federal minimum in Michigan, and we pay wage and benefits for our production labor about $15.50 on average in Michigan. So it is well above the minimum wage and $17 here in Oregon. We've also, frankly, had more tax incentives in Michigan to reinvest. Our capital investments in Michigan relative to Oregon have been about 3-1 over the last 5 years.
I have one.
Yes, Senator Decker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'm just kind of ticking through the list here of electricity, water supply, labor costs, taxes. If you had to, I guess if you were sitting with a Michigan State Senate committee, what would you say would be Oregon's competitive advantages for your industry if you were talking to them about the two states that you have plants in?
I would, again, say that Oregon is a place to recruit talent. It's fantastic. And so we are, I would prefer to maintain my sales and marketing office here in Portland. It's hard to serve the United States and internationally out of Portland. Frankly, it'd be easier if our corporate office was in Detroit, closer to our Michigan operations. But that's a key, consideration. The second one is we believe that the agricultural base here in Oregon and Washington, it is more diverse than Michigan. You can grow better fruit products in Oregon. So as we look into getting value added, as we're working on, we manufacture glacé cherries, which is a highly infused sugar cherry that goes into fruitcake. So we're selling that to Harry and David as an example. We're looking to expand that portfolio into strawberries and apples, which we've launched recently, blueberries, other, and move from cherries to other fruits as well. The source of supply in the West Coast, because we probably have to consider California also, and the premium supply is here.
Thank you. Mr. Help me with a few things here. You were talking about your costs.
Mm-hmm.
And you've already pointed out that your payroll is considerably higher than the minimum wage now on your production.
Correct.
You talked about the corn syrup because of the transportation issue was 17% higher here in glass. I'm trying to think of, in terms of, you know, these pieces of legislation, you know, what we can do about that. I mean, we can't change the fact that we don't have corn syrup, and I don't know what the glass issue is, if that's an availability or a transportation cost. But it would be helpful if you could give me some ideas of how this might impact those other costs that, that from a state standpoint, we probably can't do that much about.
I think mostly as an offset. We can develop other packaging, which we're looking into, flexible packaging, lighter weight packaging to get out of glass where the transportation cost is a key element. Most of our glass on the West Coast is produced in Seattle or California, so you're shipping a lot of air to bring it up here, and there's a lot of weight that goes into it. Transportation is also a cost consideration from Oregon to serve the rest of the United States relative to manufacturing in the Midwest. So if we can create a lighter weight package, those are the things that are within our grasp to be able to reinvest and remain competitive within the industry and continue to offer the consumer value.
Senator Starr.
Thank you. Your question, you mentioned the value of the incentives that Michigan versus Oregon is 3-1. Give us an idea of the kinds of incentives that Michigan offers that you don't see here.
I will try to detail as best I can. I'm not as close to that side of it, but in Michigan, under Governor Engler, I think about 5 years ago, established something called the Rural Renaissance Zones that offered property tax relief for reinvestment for particularly poor counties. We operate in a county called Oceana County in Michigan that had one of the highest unemployment rates. We're one of the largest employers in the county, and through this 15-year tax abatement, it was offered to us. We've been able to make some significant capital expenditures, including robots for, we have a candy manufacturing line there where we make chocolate-covered cherries. That was also tied to increased production, so it wasn't a trade of robotics for people. Our payroll's gone up there as well. Our actual headcount now exceeds about 300 at peak, and that's relative to where we were maybe 6 or 7 years ago, about 40% higher.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members.
Thank you. Thank you. We have both Townsends here.
Yeah.
To testify.
Here. Well, I'll start first.
Welcome.
Welcome this morning to all of you, the committee. First of all, Townsend
Farms. Identify yourself for the record.
Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead. I didn't hear what you said, Rick.
Identify yourself.
Oh, Mike Townsend from Townsend Farms. Excuse me.
Thanks, Mike.
Townsend Farms has been operating for about 25 years. We have two plants, one in Gresham, Fairview area, and one in the Woodburn area. We're the largest farmer in the state of Oregon for fruit, blueberries, raspberries, strawberries, blackberries. We're also here to represent a number of other processors, people like Scenic Fruit Company, Norpac, Decker Farms, Rain Sweet, just to name a few. So, and in looking at us, you're also looking at an industry. It's not just towns and farms. If you could look past us, you'd also see 1,000 growers, smaller family growers that grow Marion blackberries, strawberries, blueberries. Rick, right away, though, I want to answer one of your questions. You ask a question in terms of transition. We've lost tonnage in the state of Oregon in strawberries. We used to do about, and Laurie and I talked about this prior to the start of the meeting, we used to do about 80 million pounds of strawberries. Now we do about 25 million. The blackberry growers have increased from about 20 million to about 40 million pounds of product. So we've seen an increase there. We've lost in raspberries. We used to do about 20 million pounds. We do about 7 million pounds. But we've gained in blueberries from approximately 8 to 9 million to about close to 30 million pounds. So we do have some real positive signs of growth that have been kind of replacements to those other two crops that are now being grown, and of course in other places cheaper. I guess, you know, from the standpoint of economic expansion, you know, we look to what are we going to be able to do in the future to cover rising health care costs, employee incentives to keep good workforce. Our payroll is about $9 million. I think it's one of the larger ones in the state of Oregon. We service customers like Sam's Club, Kroger, Safeway, Cisco. Quite frankly, we've taken over the Conway plant. It went out of business. It was called an asset purchase, meaning we bought it for about a third of the price. I kind of want to go from there into really what I feel is most important on my heart is what's called economic obsolescence. That green sheet that is showing in terms of plant closure, and I want to use Norpac as an example for you all today. They were being taxed at $82 million. There was a six-year litigation there in terms of trying to lower their tax base. They've done that. They're now being taxed at $28 million. So the difference between $84 million and $28 million humbly is going to come out of about $7 million that can be used for schools, police, fire. For example, Norpac received $4.5 million back. $1.2 million of that went to Kaiser School District, as an example. Townsend Farms is going to get some assistance there and probably to the tune of about $50,000. We're not anywhere near the size of Norpac. The reason I state that is that I want to create a connection between what our industry does in terms of manufacturing and how we support school, fire, and police. I don't want something for nothing. I'd like to be able to stand on my own 2 feet. Our company would, and so would our growers. I think we can. We've switched to mechanization, picking machines, and a lot of what we're doing. But my point is this, is we need to work together, not as Democrats and Republicans, but really as people building relationship to try to talk about how we can support one another. When you see a agronomist, a field man, forklift driver, quality control person, those are all people that are important that are helping with their jobs to pay taxes, to create the great state that we live in. And I also, you know, want to echo Josh's comment that we truly love where we live. If we don't solve those issues, companies like ourselves have choices. Those issues are going to have to be solved somewhere else, basically by Democrats and Republicans. There's going to be more emphasis put on those people making the decisions when we've lost manufacturing. And I want to make it clear that I believe we can compete, but we just have to collectively come together to talk about how we can compete. My largest competitor that's growing is in that Oceania area, which is Peterson Farms. And they've got the subsidizing situation back in Michigan for their plant, their freezer. I guess, you know, from the standpoint of economic expansion, you know, we look to what are we going to be able to do in the future to cover rising health care costs, employee incentives, keep good workforce. Our payroll is about $9 million. I think it's one of the larger ones in the state of Oregon. We service customers like Sam's Club, Kroger, Safeway, Cisco. Quite frankly, we've taken over the Conway plant. It went out of business. It was called an asset purchase, meaning we bought it for about a third of the price. I kind of want to go from there into really what I feel is most important on my heart is what's called economic obsolescence. That green sheet that is showing in terms of plant closure. And I want to use NORPAC as an example for you all today. They were being taxed at $82 million. There was a six-year litigation there in terms of trying to lower their tax base. They've done that. They're now being taxed at $28 million. So the difference between $84 million and $28 million, humbly, is going to come out of about $7 million that can be used for schools, police, fire. For example, NORPAC received $4.5 million back. $1.2 million of that went to Kaiser School District, as an example. Townsend Farms is going to get some assistance there, and probably to the tune of about $50,000. We're not anywhere near the size of NORPAC. The reason I state that is that I want to create a connection between what our industry does in terms of manufacturing and how we support school, fire, and police. I don't want something for nothing. I'd like to be able to stand on my own 2 feet. Our company would, and so would our growers. I think we can. We've switched to mechanization, picking machines, and a lot of what we're doing. But my point is this, is we need to work together, not as Democrats and Republicans, but really as people building relationship to try to talk about how we can support one another. When you see a agronomist, a field man, forklift driver, quality control person, Those are all people that are important that are helping with their jobs to pay taxes to create the great state that we live in. And I also, you know, want to echo Josh's comment that we truly love where we live. If we don't solve those issues, companies like ourselves have choices. Those issues are going to have to be solved somewhere else, basically by Democrats and Republicans. There's going to be more emphasis put on those people making the decisions when we've lost manufacturing. And I want to make it clear that I believe we can compete, but we just have to collectively come together to talk about how we can compete. My largest competitor that's growing is in that Oceania area, which is Peterson Farms. And they've got the subsidizing situation back in Michigan for their plant, their freezer. And it's interesting that it's, you know, the $5.50 an hour, which is their line workers. We buy some cherries from them. Actually, we buy some product from them, a small amount. So, you know, we don't want to leave. We don't want to go anywhere. But at the same time, we're not price setters. We're price takers. And in a bid society that we live in with Kroger and Walmart, we take the prices and we don't set them. What can we do about it? My buyers are going to ask me, Mike, what are you doing? You know, how are you going to communicate with your legislators, senators, and how are you going to be productive in a world economy? And I want to go back to them and say that with our quality, with our technical things that we do in terms of packaging, and we've got some new items out there. We've got a topping going in right now with Sam's Club. It's going to be over 550 stores. We've invested $250,000 of our own money in equipment. I hope it'll add about 7-8% to our bottom line in terms of our total sales, not our bottom line, but our total sales. So I just want to point those things out that we're collectively trying to move forward, but we really need your help in terms of working together. Really, it's about minimum wage. I want to turn it over to my son at this point.
Any questions?
Well, why don't you go ahead?
Okay. Good morning or good afternoon. My name is Billy Townsend. I'm an employee, an owner of Townsend Farms. You know, this is tough. And I don't know why it's tough. And this might be the wrong place. And Grandpa always told me, Bill, work hard and money will take care of itself. Take care of your people and they'll take care of you. Where we're going in the future with our company is more into the fresh processing part of the business, the produce part. And that takes away from the jobs. That takes away from the people. Because there's a fast reward in that business, in the processing business, where the jobs are created and the people come to work. There's a big capital investment with no capital return. Maybe never, maybe within 5 years is the closest we can get a capital return on a 100-acre blueberry planting, which could provide seasonal jobs for up to 200 people. We can't do those things because we can't compete. We just can't compete. And just my dad said, it's not just Townsend Farms up here that's going to suffer. It's the small farmer that works day in and day out like we do. Pays his payroll, gets his crop picked. It's not just the money. It's about the people. We employ 900 people seasonally. We wouldn't have a darn thing if it wasn't for them. We have relationships with our people.
Hey, Bill, tell me a little bit about the work that you've done in the business.
I came out of high school, got married real young, loved what I do, loved family business, grew up in it my whole life. I had a close relationship with our controller who's been with us for over 20 years. Got down and started going over the books and looking at what was the most profitable part of our business. And at the time, it was the fresh produce part. And at the time, it was the smallest part of our gross income to towns and farms. So I decided to take off from there. Dad said, Billy, do whatever you want. My uncle said, Bill, do whatever you want. So I went from there and built it up over time to become 60 to 70% of our company's total gross income on what I started 7 years ago. And the main part of what I do is employing these 900 workers, these pickers, these people in the plant. It's subsidizing the frozen part of our business. And it's a profitable deal. But for us to go on what I'm doing, we have to have the cannery part of it. And we have to have the cannery, because that's what makes me tick too. You know, whatever doesn't go fresh goes into a bag, a frozen bag. It goes into a smoothie. And we need that so I can stay competitive in what I do. We want to plant more blueberries. He said we buy 30 million pounds of blueberries. Do you know?
No, we buy 12 million.
We buy 12 million pounds? Okay. The state of Oregon produces 30 million pounds of blueberries, okay? 30 million. We buy in about 12. And the reason we buy in 12, we farm about 2.5 to 3 towns and farms. I take all that in the fresh. The other fruit, we're not buying out of Oregon. We're buying out of states like Michigan. We're buying out of Michigan, North Carolina, New Jersey, because we could buy a cheaper product. Is it as quality a product? No. It proves in the fresh. They're giving me the quality product so I can go value added. I have tremendous growth in what I'm doing, tremendous growth. But this is the sad point, is the biggest part of the growth by with what I'm doing with the product, it comes the marketing. You know, I have a tremendous advantage over my competition because, you know, we have the lowest general administrative expenses in our industry, towns and farms. We don't take big salaries. We put it back in to grow. You know, if you take a look at the fruit processing business in Oregon over the last 20 years, we're one of the only ones left that are a farmer processor. And business is a funny thing, you know. We don't live big lifestyles. We reinvest back in our business so we can have a place to come to work. We can have a relationship with our employees. And it's being taken away. It's, you know, this increase, it's the minimum wage, it hit our bottom line by $600,000 when it went from 7 to 7.25. I don't know how many years we can keep doing that. We need some help. All we're asking for is a little help. The last time I came and spoke in front of senators, you know, everybody else behind us was asking for a handout. We don't ask for handouts. We pay our taxes. We pay debt on the operating line. We pay our employees. We never asked for nothing. We don't ask for handouts. We go to work every day and work hard. The money will take care of itself. We need help. You know, that's it. Any questions?
Thank you, Bill. You know, your dad and I had a good conversation 2 years ago in my office and talking about that very issue when everybody else wanted to pile in, and you might remember we had that discussion. You know, you might need the help. Intel really doesn't, and that's how the process unfortunately works. People want to jump in on things, and we lose focus of really where that help really is needed. And so I understand and appreciate that. I don't know if you know, but my wife's grandparents started Scenic Fruit Company. The Lauterbachs, and her cousin still runs that. I don't know, you know, right. Scenic, 1932, family-run business just like Townsend, and you know, it's one of the last ones, family-owned, that's still around. And I remember going there last winter and looking around and went into the freezer, and they had frozen strawberries that they had just received from Poland. And to process, just to keep the workers to keep jobs for folks. So I understand and appreciate what you do, and I appreciate you taking the time to come. Questions for Mike or Bill?
I'd like to know, Mr.
Yes.
Chair, with the tax credit that would be permitted or that would result from these two bills, tell me exactly how it would help you. I know you said that NORPAC won a suit. $82 million was their taxed base, and now it's down to $28 million. Now, these two bills wouldn't necessarily make a difference there, but can you explain to me a little bit more about what that is, what that means?
Okay, you know, here's exactly the way it works is, basically, you know, industry is waged by its economic value and what it produces and its profits. And we've lost those numbers of plants, those 15 plants. So the value of those plants is diminished. And when that value diminishes, you have a situation where you're being overtaxed because of your throughput and your profitability. And, you know, honestly, we probably as a group have not done a good enough job 5-10 years ago of educating the state on what we're doing. And now we're at a point where we've become very passionate about trying to stay in business, and it's just a matter of economics and dollars. I mean, it's not something that we can't have a future, and it's a matter of help and making people understand. I mean, we house these people. We create trailer parks for them. We've invested almost $2 million. So, you know, we have a lot of infrastructure that actually takes care of the people. Yeah. We spend $22,000 on security. So
we spend over $100,000 a year in maintaining those labor facilities for people to live in. So they have a nice place to come and stay, a respectable place.
And that
provide them with their food, $20,000 up front for their food when they come into work. Try to do the best we can.
And you know, I think, Lori, where the issue is that if we can come together and draw a line between the diminished value of the plants in the state, we can come together and see the fact that we're paying less taxes and we're not being able to support the schools, because education is, as far as I'm concerned, is the most important thing that we have. And we have to be able to keep supporting that. And I don't want a handout. I want to just be able to compete on an equal playing field. Does that answer?
Yes, that does. And I have a bias towards Townsend Farms since my son worked for Townsend Farms for about 7 years.
Yeah,
while
did.
He was in high school and college.
Other questions?
Just a comment, Mr.
Senator Decker.
I think, and I'll speak for myself because I think it's more valuable. Senator Starr knows farming very well and has an agricultural district in the background. Senator Metzger and Senator Mona Sanderson do too. And I don't. I represent a pretty urban area or suburban area, and so I think it's really valuable for me to hear the story of Townsend Farms and to hear it with passion. And so I think sometimes people wonder if they should come out, and unfortunately the platform we have, we come out because we want to be closer, and this platform's kind of a tough one, but I can tell you that I really benefit from hearing about the workings of your farm and the challenges that you have here in Oregon and globally, and just thank you for taking the time. And it does, if you do wonder, it does make an impact, at least for me, probably would be the one up here that would need it the most.
I really appreciate that.
Thank you. I feel like I'm on American Idol.
Thank you both very much. Our last sign up testimony is Jerry Gardner, Oregon Department of Agriculture.
Good morning, Chairman Metzger and members of the committee. I've got a handout here for you called Oregon Agriculture. It's not just a pretty picture. For the record, my name is Jerry Gardner. I'm the Business Development Manager for the Oregon Department of Agriculture, the Agriculture Development and Marketing Division. My office is located at the Food Innovation Center in downtown Portland. ODA, the Department of Agriculture, is not taking a position on either Senate Bill 365 or Senate Bill 479, but I'm here today to briefly describe the importance of agriculture and food processing to Oregon's economy. Overall, the farm gate value of Oregon's agricultural products reached $3.8 billion in 2004. Producers purchased over $3.4 billion of goods and services to help generate that kind of farm gate value. Value-added processing added in excess of $1.5 billion. The agricultural payroll for the state was about $2.3 billion. We estimate then, when you add those up, that the direct contribution to Oregon's economy of the agriculture and food processing sector is about $11.5 billion. I've given you a list there of the top 10 agriculture-producing counties. Marion County is the largest agriculture county in the state at $486 million. I won't spend time going down these. I'll try to be brief this morning. Oregon's agriculture is an economic engine. In 1964, it was about $428 million, and now it's up to $3.8 billion. That's a 788% increase, or about 5.6% compounded annually. The employment figures, about 150,000 Oregonians are engaged in various occupations relating to agriculture. That's 8 to 9% of Oregon's total employment, about one in every 12 Oregonians. Exports are an important part of Oregon agriculture. We ship about 80% of what's produced here outside the state of Oregon, and we ship about 40% of that to foreign countries. Agriculture and food products are the second largest export sector in terms of value and first in terms of volume. This accounts to about 19% of the state's total exports, 60% of the exports going through the Port of Portland. And I've got some figures there that computers and electronics products currently top Oregon's export list, about $2.3 billion. But if you add all the farm gates and processed agriculture, we're up to about $885 million. That puts us in second position. Japan's our largest trading partner. Value added, as I mentioned, $1.5 billion. I think Ken gave some figures here, more recent figures, that it's about $1.87 billion now. Most of that is centered in the metro area. Multnomah County leads Oregon food processing with about 24% of the state's food processing payroll. Probably a little known fact. Nearly 20% of the employees. Marion County down in the Willamette Valley, of course, is second. The average pay per worker in Marion County involved in agriculture is $36,000 a year. In Marion County, it's $26,000 a year. I've got a chart there that shows food processing employment, showing that Multnomah County has about 4,320 people employed. And then it gives the payroll figures. Total for the state's about 21,000 people involved in food processing. So, counting agriculture and the related industry activity, economic contribution to Oregon gross state product is second only to high tech. A lot of people are kind of waiting for agriculture to go away or don't think it's that important, but it's very important to Oregon's economy. Some of the challenges that we're facing here, as been mentioned, globalization. We're competing on an international stage. In this area, you face competition from pears grown in Chile, berries produced in Canada and elsewhere, processed goods coming from Europe. That's a big factor. Consolidation is another one. A lot of our customers are fewer, larger, and they dictate the price. Production costs continue to climb. The price of fuel, fertilizer, electricity, all increase. Labor costs have been mentioned. They have risen more than 100% over the last decade and remain the highest single expense Oregon producers have, of over $863 million a year in the year 2000. Oregon minimum wage is one of the highest in the nation. There are uncertainties with water, uncertainties on the land use side with things like Measure 37 and expansion of the urban growth boundaries. But we have a number of strengths. the diversity of our crops and production regions. We have in excess of 225 commercially grown agricultural crops in the state of Oregon. We have a reputation for high quality. We're recognized for our efforts in sustainability, technology, innovation. We're aggressive marketers. We have port facility, and we still have assets for soil and water and the like. So can we compete? Yes. Oregon agriculture is gaining strength in many areas. Net farm income is up. Agriculture exports are up. There are new opportunities for innovation, niche marketing, certification programs. More resources are coming from the federal government for conservation efforts. And we have new opportunities relating to renewable energy that are coming. So, but agriculture can still use all the help that it can get. After all, what would Oregon be without Oregon agriculture? Thanks for the opportunity to testify this morning, and Chairman Metzger, I'll try to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you, Mr. Gardner. I did note that you haven't taken an official position, and I understand that from the department, but I would be curious as to your evaluation if these two bills, and at least substantially their existing form, were to be in effect, what would be your professional opinion of what this would or would not do in terms of the food processing industry in the state?
I think both bills would add to our competitiveness, and as I mentioned, as we see our markets increase competition, from overseas, also from the fewer places we have to sell our products, all that pushes down on these rising costs, and our processors and our producers are squeezed. So these two bills would help offset that kind of a disadvantage, and I think they would be important to the industry as a whole.
Thank you. Questions?
Yes.
Senator Montagerson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, Gresham used to be the strawberry capital of the world. And now, evidently, it used to be, now it's in somewhere in Florida, what I heard.
California.
It was in California. And where there's a big difference, I think, in farming with nursery versus what I call real farming, farms that really grow the produce that we eat. And I see that the nurseries maybe get subsidies or would be a part of this, but that's not where I feel the real need is. The real need is in the berry farmers, in those that grow potatoes and pears and apples. And I don't know if this bill, these tax credits could be focused more on those farms that are truly in need. And I don't know the difference on when you give these $3.8 billion, what part of that is from the nursery industry, what part of that is from the real farming. I shouldn't say real farming, but that's how I'm going to say it, real farming industry.
Chairman Metzger, Senator Maya Sanderson, the nursery industry is about a $727 million a year industry of that $3.8 billion. There are about 1,600 nurserymen growing about 4,500 different species of plants. Yes, this kind of help would help those folks as well. You know, I think if your question is, could this be applied to others in the industry to help them? Yes, I think it could. I don't know where the bill will be going long term, but I think that could be helpful as well.
Mr. H., you want to make a comment on that?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, and Senator Montes Anderson. Ken Yates, again, for the record, Northwest Food Processors. The two pieces of legislation before you today are highly targeted to the most distressed sectors of the food manufacturing industry. Both bills are targeted primarily towards, well, entirely towards fruit and vegetable, seafood, and dry bakery. The dry bakery, frankly, is for the Kraft Nabisco facility in Portland that is a member of our association. That facility was built in 1950. They've invested a great deal of technology into it. But again, in this global environment and increasing costs, that facility is on the bubble, and several hundred employees in Northeast Industrial Portland area on Columbia Boulevard are at stake. I think you're acquainted with the struggles in the seafood industry, seafood processing. So it's just those sectors that have been identified by North American industry codes in the bill that will be benefiting from this legislation. I also put a list of the fruit and vegetable companies and their city locations in your packet. They're right behind the bills and bill summaries. Those would be the companies and their locations in our membership that would benefit, and we represent most of the fruit and vegetable industry. Virtually all of it.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you. Actually, I just thank everybody for the testimony. That both Townsends, I appreciate your testimony. I just think it's been really, really helpful. And my only regret is that you're speaking to only four members of a 30-member Senate.
They're pretty influential, my three colleagues. So.
Yeah, well, but four members of a 90-member legislature, and I think that these issues, and I know you've got the industry has able representation in the building that carry that message, but to hear the passion and the real face of the industry this morning has been very helpful. And I support these bills, and I hope that we can move them forward, and I hope that they can come through the legislative process. The question that I've been rolling in my mind, and it's bigger than these two bills, and since we're talking about agriculture and we're talking about food products and we're talking about international trade, talking about consolidation of an industry, we're talking about creating niche markets. Land use policy is, as was mentioned, some of the risks to an industry. And, maybe I'm going to get to a question, but maybe this will end up just being a statement. The issue of providing food to Oregonians, to Americans, is something that I think we need to have a much broader conversation about. And I'm all for borders that allow for trade internationally, and I think that's important, but at some level, when we're talking about a world that is at war on certain levels, and the threat or the ability for folks with bad motives to harm Americans, food is one of those places that I think is an attractive place. And, I think that at some level, the importance of feeding Oregonians, feeding Americans, ought to be sent to folks that are oceans away. And we ought to find ways to create that that infrastructure so that we can maintain those farm families that really feed not only Oregonians but feed Americans, and to a certain level, as we see through the Port of Portland, feed the world. Mr. Chair, I think that's just a statement. I don't know if either one of these wanted to comment on that, but I think that this is a much bigger issue than these two bills that are sitting in front of us today.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Vice Chairman.
Um, And I support these bills, and I hope that we can move them forward, and I hope that they can come through the legislative process. The question that I've been rolling in my mind, and it's bigger than these two bills, and since we're talking about agriculture and we're talking about food products and we're talking about international trade, talking about consolidation of an industry, we're talking about creating niche markets, land use policy, as was mentioned, some of the risks to an industry. And, you know, maybe I'm going to get to a question, but maybe this will end up just being a statement. The issue of providing food to Oregonians, to Americans, is something that I think we need to have a much broader conversation about. And, you know, I'm all for, you know, borders that allow for trade internationally, and I think that's important. But at some level, when we're talking about a world that is at war on certain levels, and the threat or the ability for folks with bad motives to harm Americans, you know, food is one of those places that I think is an attractive place. And you know, I think that at some level, the importance of feeding Oregonians, feeding Americans, ought to be sent to folks that are oceans away, and we ought to find ways to create that that infrastructure so that we can maintain those farm families that really feed not only Oregonians but feed Americans, and to a certain level, as we see through the Port of Portland, feed the world. Mr. Chair, I think that's just a statement. I don't know if either one of these wanted to comment on that, but I think that this is a much bigger issue than these two bills that are sitting in front of us today.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Vice Chairman. You know, I think everyone is wrapping themselves up in national security these days, obviously for legitimate reasons on many, many issues. Our association has done a great deal of work in partnership with all levels of government and our members to ensure the safety of the Northwest food supply. I won't detail those efforts now, but 20, 30 years down the road, if America becomes a net food importer, there are huge national security implications to that. If we think our dependence on foreign oil is a national security threat, and it is, imagine mainland China holding a food threat over our heads. We have absolutely got to compete globally. There's no escaping that. There's no substitute for success in competing globally in the international food market.
Questions?
Thank you.
Thank you,
thank you,
Mr.
Very Chairman, much. Members.
Well, members, we have heard the testimony. I think that clearly, in my view, we need to move these bills along to the next level. I think there is certainly substantial evidence here that this is an area that needs our attention, and fortunately, our chair of revenue, which is the referral for these bills, should we move them, is here hearing the testimony. I think that's been very, very valuable. So with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bills 365 and 479, and I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 365 and request a due pass recommendation to the Revenue Committee on Senate Bill 365.
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Senator Starr has moved Senate Bill 365 to the Committee on Revenue with the due pass recommendation. Discussion? Objection? So ordered. I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 479. Senator Starr.
Mr. Chair, I'd move Senate Bill 479 to the Committee on Revenue with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved Senate Bill 479 to the Committee on Revenue with the due pass recommendation. Discussion? Objection? So ordered. So we will continue this process. Thank you very much for your testimony. Okay. Okay, we're going to open up a public hearing on Bill 421. And according to my notes, somewhere, right buried here. Jared Broadfoot is the only one I have set to testify. It's in a bill 421. You want to go ahead, Ms. Van Winkle, and just give us the summary of Senate Bill 421 for those in the
certainly.
Audience.
Mr. Chair, committee members, Senate Bill 421 is brought to you by the Committee on Rules at the request of the Oregon State Building and Construction Trades Council. It requires the Director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services to establish building code administrative regions for all areas of the state. It provides for the appointment of department employees for each region to administer and enforce state building code within the region. It also imposes a surcharge on permit fees and hourly charges to defray costs of administering and enforcing the state code. It also declares an emergency effective on passage. You also have in front of you some dash two amendments, which further clarify the intent of the bill.
Thank you very much. Mr. Broadfoot.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jared Broadfoot with PacWest Communications, here today representing the Oregon State Building and Construction Trades Council, the National Electrical Contractors Association, Plumbing and Mechanical Contractors Association, and the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers. I'll stop there and won't continue going. You get the point. Senate Bill 421, let me explain first the problem that we're trying to fix with Senate Bill 421. Contractors across the state run into numerous problems when they go to different jurisdictions, and the problem they run into is a different interpretation of one Oregon State building code. For instance, they could go and do a project in Medford and go down to Ashland or back up to Portland or over to LeGrand and have 3 to 4 or 5 different interpretations of the state building code from different building officials. We need to fix that problem, and this bill we think is a solution so we can have folks in those regions to deal with those conflicts at a local level instead of having those conflicts come all the way up to the state and requiring a state interpretation of that code for each of these problems. These folks, I think the intent is to have about 3 folks throughout the state in different regions that will be able to work proactively with building officials, building departments, and contractors to resolve these conflicts. We've had several members in the House and in the Senate who have come to us early in the session and said, this is a problem, we need to fix this. And of course our answer is, well then, we've got Senate Bill 421, please take a look at it. The amendments, the dash two amendments, were requested by the Oregon Building Officials Association. They wanted some clarification as far as what our intent was on this bill, and their amendments are fine with one exception. On page 1 of the dash twos, line 10, it says in line 17, delete 4 and insert promote. That actually should be provide. And I'm not sure if the committee would be willing to make that a conceptual amendment or not, but that's the only issue, and I spoke with Bill Cross. They're happy with the amendments with that change. So are we. They said they support the bill. Also spoke with the League of Oregon Cities. They're supportive of the bill as well. As far as we know, there's no opposition to this bill. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions, or if the committee would like me to go into a little bit more detail about the specifics of the bill. But obviously, we've got a problem with the statewide interpretation the code for contractors all the way up from general contractors down to our subcontractors, and we need to have our construction processes be as smooth and seamless as possible, and having to deal with us going up to the state for an interpretation of the code takes a lot of time away from those projects and costs money.
Thank you, Mr. Broadfoot. We don't have anybody from Building Codes here. Have you worked with the Department of the Consumer Business Services Building Codes Division on this and have their interpretation of your effort here?
Yes. As far as the technical aspects of the bill and the amendments, they said they look appropriate. They're not taking a position. Obviously, this has a fiscal impact, and they're not going to be advocating for spending more money, but obviously we are. So, yes, they've looked at it and have no technical problems with the bill and would be able to carry the bill out if it were passed and signed.
Can you tell me from your experience with those who you represent, has there been a particular part of the state more than others that, in terms of interpreting the Uniform Building Code, that you've had more difficulty with?
I would have to say the Medford area is the first one that pops up because of the population down there and the different projects that we do. I think that would be one of the areas. You know, we've really been able to deal with this problem very well in the Tri-County area because of the Tri-County Board. So I would say if one area stuck up more than any, it would be probably Medford, followed by Central Oregon, the Bend area.
So am I correct in assuming, as I look over this bill, that you're attempting to essentially replicate what we've done in the Tri-County area and the other regions of the state?
Absolutely, yes.
Questions for Mr. Broadfoot? Senator Starr.
Just a technical one as it relates to the amendment. As I read the amendment, on page 4 of the bill, it's the front page of the amendment, it says on line 16 of the amendment, on page 4, delete lines 5 and 6 and insert. I don't see in the amendment where the sections or lines 7 through 10, are lines 7 through 10 renumbered somewhere? Seems like maybe they should be deleted as well as lines 5 and 6. Not sure that the numbers in the amendment match that bill well.
Mr. Chair, Senator Starr, that's a good question.
The amendment says on line 16, delete on page 4, delete lines 5 and 6 and insert, and then they have section 6, so you're replacing the section 6, but it doesn't delete the in the bill, section 6, sub 2, paragraph 2. And in the amendment, you create a new paragraph 2 of section 6. So it looks like in my read of this, you have two sub 2s of section 6. So it's just a technical issue with the amendment, unless someone else sees something that I don't see.
Yeah, talking the numbering, is that right, Senator Starr?
Because well, we have two. It's numbering, but it.
Mm-hmm. So that's an operative date. What's left is an operative date in section 6. And then section 7. Well, section 7 refers to section 2.
Yeah, it looks to me it would be appropriate on line 16 of the amendments, the first page, that it would be that we would need to delete more lines than just 5 and 6 to completely take out section 2.
That would be my read, but I just don't know if we needed to keep that section 2 and renumber it somewhere. So that's just kind of a technical issue.
And Mr. Chair?
Yes.
With this amendment, has Department of Consumer and Business Services seen the amendment?
Yes, they have.
Okay, because it's my question is there an economic impact when you're asking to develop and administer an installation label program, developing standard application forms and procedures, developing standard forms and procedures for building permits? I mean, to me, it seems like there is an economic impact.
There is. In fact, we're working on legislative fiscal is working on that, and this bill would go to Ways and Means because it would have a fiscal impact. Any substantive questions, first of all? Any other substantive questions? I think what we're going to do, because we not only have that a problem with line 10, but with the ones that Senator Starr is, so we don't have to do this on the fly and then have to come back and do it again. I'll have you work with Ms. Van Winkle to make sure that the amendment is correct and where it's wrong, corrected, so for a dash 3. And then we will schedule this bill then for a work session on Tuesday, because since we have heard the bill, we can do that. Mm-hmm. Make sure that we have the amendment correct, and then move it on. That way, we won't have to waste anybody's time on that one. Appreciate that very much, and I know the Tri-County system has worked well, and to the extent that we can make sure that the Uniform Building Code is managed well, I think that's a good objective. We'll see what the fiscal is, and we'll see what happens, but we will send it forthwith to Ways and Means.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. I think just from speaking with the Department of Consumer and Business Services, they're estimating about a $500,000 fiscal impact for a two-year period, so that's about $250,000 a year, which would be roughly $75,000 per individual. That covers computer costs, cubicle costs, because they're going to house these folks in the region, so that would include their salary and all that stuff. So we feel it's cost-effective.
All right. Well, we'll bring that back. We'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 421. And where are we going to go next here? I always lose track of all my own agendas.
We can do
All right, yeah, let's do that. We'll go just a little bit out of order. We've got a couple that are tied together. So I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 879. And
can I go first?
And we'll ask Senator Montes Anderson to introduce this to us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When I talked with the city of Gresham, I was saying, what can we do in the legislature to help our process, our economic development process? And this is the idea that actually came out of the city of Gresham regarding the strategic investment program. We have two main industries in Gresham, the LSI and Microchip, and they have a lot of land with them, and a lot of the land could be actually put to better economic use for the city, and this bill attempts to do that. And from there, I would turn it over to our guest.
Hey, welcome.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
Good morning, Senator Metzger and committee. My name is Paul Warking, and I am a member of the Gresham City Council. I'm here today to testify in support of the Senate Bill 879, which modifies the Strategic Investment Program, commonly known as SIP, to allow for the pre-establishment of strategic investment zones in selected geographical areas. As you're probably aware, we do have two large companies in the Gresham area who are under the SIP program, namely LSI and Microchip Technologies, and these were established several years ago. Tax benefits were part of the equation of this SIP program, which we feel was part of the factor of in convincing them to establish in East County. Gresham, as you're aware, has also spent considerable time and investment to annex two strategic areas between Damascus and Gresham, known as Pleasant Valley and Springwater. The Pleasant Valley is more of a planned residential community, whereas Springwater, which we're talking about today, is a mixed-use community with emphasis on available industrial land. The benefits of this bill, it would set up a framework in advance to simplify existing cumbersome and time-consuming application procedures by having just one public process. But we'd like to emphasize it would not negate the social incentives for job creation and training under the existing SIP legislation. It would also enable us to have shovel-ready industrial properties pre-approved for the tax advantages to be able to take off the SIP program. The potential use for traded sector clusters, which is featured in this program, would put our annexation area of Springwater at a distinct advantage to attract both internal and external corporate companies where time is of the essence when we're competing with a national market arena. In conclusion, your support today of this important bill to facilitate the growth of Oregon and East County's economies would be appreciated.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Go ahead, proceed.
Good morning. Thank you very much for this invitation to speak to the committee about the SIP program and Senate Bill 579. My name is Ken Frost. I'm the finance director for the LSI Gresham site. I've been there 10 years. Proud to say I was the second Oregonian they hired here. LSI did, so still around for 10 years. I'll try to keep my comments brief and really to the point of the overall benefits that we've enjoyed as part of this public-private partnership that we've had with Multnomah County and the City of Gresham under the terms of the SIP. The property tax abatement provided through the SIP was very much a critical factor in our decision to come to Oregon. Our decision was to invest over $1 billion in assets. We've hired over 700 employees that range from operators to technicians to professionals and managers. We've spent over $700 million in local goods and services. Without the SIP, the decision would have probably been made to move to Texas as opposed to Oregon. So it was very much a critical factor for us. Property taxes are a very significant portion of the expense of a large-scale manufacturing operation like what we have in Gresham. The profitability of our operation is very much driven by how well we manage those fixed costs. So property taxes and finding ways to reduce those if we can are very key to our cost strategy. The SIP did provide Oregon, I think, a very distinct advantage over other states and actually over other countries as well, in the way they used their tax incentives to stimulate investment, hiring, procurement, and tax revenues. The SIP really has yielded, I think, very tangible benefits, obviously, on the tax side, but I think also, too, the way the program is structured has really forged, I think, some several intangible benefits, one being the fact that we have a very strong relationship with the city and the county. We worked on a variety of things beyond just what's in the SIP program, ranging from economic development to building public infrastructure, environmental management, as well as education and training programs. And I think also, too, the SIP has instilled a very strong sense of accountability in our operation because we have a series of metrics we have to meet in terms of headcount, environmental programs, transportation programs, and so forth. I think also, too, the SIP, from what I can tell, is I think we've established a very strong strategic anchor with the SIP program by having LSI come to East County. We've been able to attract a number of other businesses, suppliers, and customers, as well as bringing forth a very highly educated workforce to support the plant. There's no question that the tax abatements, the raw dollars being in control, or I like to look at the raw dollars, didn't give us a very significant benefit to our cost structure, but I really believe that the public-private partnership that was created out of the SIP program was equally beneficial to us being a successful operation in Gresham. In regards to the SIP zone proposal, certainly we would support any proposal that shortens time between, candidate engagement and having a shovel-ready site. The legislation is expected to contribute to Oregon's aggressive strategies for attracting new business and stimulating much-needed economic growth in Oregon. Although we can't really endorse any specific economic development program in East County, we believe the creation of a strategic investment zone to attract world-class investment will enhance Oregon's ability to compete in the world markets. That's the end of my presentation. I'm glad to take any questions.
Questions for this gentleman. No. John, you want to come forward? Do a presentation.
Thank you, Senator Metzger and committee. Senator Deckard, in lieu of a full theatrical production, we're going to have a modest PowerPoint.
PowerPoint?
Does it have any animation in it?
Yes. We would like to bring you up to date a little bit on the progress of the spring water plan, primarily because this is one of the areas that Gresham is thinking of that a strategic investment program zone would occur, and also to kind of tie the package together of how this works to help encourage economic development in Oregon and certainly in East County. First of all, this is a comprehensive project, one that involves not just kind of pretty pictures and land use planning, but the entire package of urban services and annexation. This is sewer, water, storm drain, transportation, parks, schools, funding and financing and an aggressive strategy to market this as well. As you know, the Springwater area brings much-needed jobs to east part of the region. This not only helps the financial viability of the community of Gresham, but it helps transportation throughout the East County. Actually, by putting, we'd model this with a number of jobs in the east side of the region. Congestion increases a little bit around that, but certainly decreases way up into the east side of the county. The area that we're looking at is has a lot of beautiful features. It's located on the Springwater Trail near Johnson Creek. You can go all the way into downtown Portland. It's located on Highway 26. It also has a number of challenges, lots of small parcels, slope and so forth, and we've worked with the community developing a master plan, looking at lots of options, doing fairly sophisticated modeling, and coming up with a concept plan that now is coming up for adoption and should be on the ground in June. We expect shovel-ready progress on this several months after that. Taking a look at this, first of all, you can see the crown jewel of this is about 500 acres of industrial land around Highway 26. This is where the SIP zone would be primarily located. This is intended to bring in strategic investment of strategic businesses. This is an area that conservatively would accommodate about 5 million square feet of industrial buildings, between 7,500 and 10,000 new employees in this area. This is the kinds of businesses that are the heart of the Oregon economy and the growth in the Oregon economy. We're also, obviously, this is an area that Highway 26 goes right by it. We're working with ODOT on studies for new interchanges and new accesses, looking at phasing in from at-grade intersections to finally my personal favorite. There's been no decisions made, but this one really ties the two ends together and ties the whole project together with a split diamond interchange, really making this a wonderfully accessible site from one that is not so accessible at this time. There's some site, there's another about 150 acres on the other side of Johnson Creek that is not as suitable for industrial land. This will be for office and for light manufacturing, small manufacturing plants. About 2 million square feet of new development, about 4,900 to 6,000 new employees. And then there's some other features of this. There's a small volcanic lava dome that we're setting aside for executive housing. Right next to the Persimmon Golf Course. There's this area, this wooded area in between two creeks that is going to be single-family residential, beautiful neighborhoods. There's an area that is designed to have a boulevard down the middle of it that's be townhouse and small homes, very much like, I know Senator Starr recognizes this, the Orenco Village. Finally, there's a village, a mixed-use village that provides services, entertainment for the residents and the 15,000 employees in the area. Down at the end of the boulevard there, you'll see a hilltop park separating that with a view of Mount Hood. This is, you know, one of the more beautiful sites you could develop, and it also is got a solid business plan behind it. The city of Gresham is committed to getting the infrastructure and the annexation, the approvals in place ahead of time so that projects that come into this can really get going quickly. I work nationally. We do a lot of work in Texas and up and down the West Coast. And I can tell you that businesses that are looking at this are stuck between two areas. In Texas, kind of everything goes. But you have a very unstable environment when you locate your business there. You don't know what's going to happen around you. And I can tell you after working in the Austin area that the investors there are very uncertain about the future of that Austin area because of the lack of planning. On the other hand, when you come to the West Coast, you might find a well-planned area in Washington or California, but their environmental review process, which really doesn't allow you to take advantage of pre-planning, you have to go through a year-long process fraught with uncertainty and potential appeals by somebody. I think in Oregon, one of our strengths is we provide that high-quality, secure environment, but we can also provide with our governmental system pre-approvals so that this area is zoned ready to go. The annexation is understood. It goes quickly. It's not something that you have to go through a big deal about. Making this a strategic investment zone adds to that pre-approval concept that is frankly our strength in a national environment. You can come here, you have security of a well-planned area, you know your investments and your employees are going to be happy there, but you also can get your approvals done in a matter of months, not years. You don't have options for appeals and a long rigmarole. The ability to get through the hearing of the SIP zone and be able to do that along with the other pre-approvals that we're arranging for this area is going to make Gresham and the Springwater area tremendously competitive. So basically, just a summary, incentive to capital intensive industries, it stimulates associated development. There's 15,000 employees, over $1 billion of investment that will come to this area outside of anything that the strategic investment program has to do. But it makes it feasible for quick decisions to be made. And I think that's one of the key advantages to this, to Gresham and to other communities that would take advantage of it. Thank you. Any questions?
Questions? Senator Moss-Anderson.
Thank you. Just to clarify then, there are several different businesses that may want to locate in the Springwater region.
That's correct.
So each one would not have to go through the laborious SIP application process because we will have had a strategic investment program approval for the entire area.
That's correct, there's several hearings involved now between the city, the county. There's many opportunities, and as I've heard earlier today, those can be nasty hearings. It's not something you want to drag a newcomer to the state through. You can get through the local discussions that you need to have with the community about this, and then a set of criteria that when a company meets that criteria, it's an administrative issue. Boulevard there, you'll see a hilltop park separating that with a view of Mount Hood. This is, you know, one of the more beautiful sites you could develop, and it also is got a solid business plan behind it. The city of Gresham is committed to getting the infrastructure and the annexation, the approvals in place ahead of time so that projects that come into this can really get going quickly. I work nationally. We do a lot of work in Texas and up and down the West Coast. And I can tell you that businesses that are looking at this are stuck between two areas. In Texas, kind of everything goes, but you have a very unstable environment when you locate your business there. You don't know what's going to happen around you. And I can tell you after working in the Austin area that the investors there are very uncertain about the future of that Austin area because of the lack of planning. On the other hand, when you come to the West Coast, you might find a well-planned area in Washington or California, but their environmental review process, which really doesn't allow you to take advantage of pre-planning, you have to go through a year-long process fraught with uncertainty and potential appeals by somebody. I think in Oregon, one of our strengths is we provide that high-quality, secure environment, but we can also provide with our governmental system pre-approvals. So that this area is zoned, ready to go. The annexation is understood. It goes quickly. It's not something that you have to go through a big deal about. Making this a strategic investment zone adds to that pre-approval concept that is frankly our strength in a national environment. You can come here, you have security of a well-planned area, you know your investments and your employees are going to be happy there, but you also can get your approvals done in a matter of months, not years. You don't have options for appeals and a long rigmarole. The ability to get through the hearing of the SIP zone and be able to do that along with the other pre-approvals that we're arranging for this area is going to make Gresham and the Springwater area tremendously competitive. So basically, just a summary, incentive to capital-intensive industries, it stimulates associated development. There's 15,000 employees, over $1 billion of investment that will come to this area outside of anything that, that the strategic investment program has to do. But it makes it feasible for quick decisions to be made. And I think that's one of the key advantages to this, to Gresham and to other communities that would take advantage of it. Thank you. Any questions?
Questions? Senator Monahan.
Thank you. Just to clarify then, there are several different businesses that may want to locate in the Springwater region.
That's correct.
So each one would not have to go through the laborious SIP application process because we will have had a strategic investment program approval for the entire area.
That's correct, and there's several hearings involved now between the city, the county. There's many opportunities, and as I've heard earlier today, those can be nasty hearings. It's not something you want to drag a newcomer to the state through. You can get through the local discussions that you need to have with the community about this. And then a set of criteria that when a company meets that criteria, it's an administrative issue. It's around the philosophy that we've had of decide what you want to have and make it easy to do what you want to have happen. And in a sense, it allows companies that are not as big as LSI or Intel that are closer to that $100 to $150 million range where you're in the investment package that you'd be in the SIP program. Allows companies like that to come in and get a decision in a matter of months along with annexation and so forth, rather than waiting for a long time and going through a long, drawn-out and very public process.
And committee follow-up, Mr. Chair. Mm-hmm. Just to let you know, the city of Gresham has spent years basically working on this project, not like some other annexations that have happened on the west side. We have really worked hard on involving the community, having community meetings, etc. So this is extremely a grassroots effort in a sense, and it would be very nice now that all this planning has to decrease the barriers that some of the businesses might have to go through who would maybe want to locate there.
The question I have is, has this bill and these amendments to the bill, have they been vetted with OECD? Have they been vetted with, say, Washington County, who's also had a significant amount of experience with the SIP?
I'm going to ask successful way. City of Gresham representative to answer that.
Mr. Chair, Senator Starr, Ron Papstor for the City of Gresham. We've had initial conversations with OECD, have not heard any objections to the bill at this point. I've talked to Washington County staff about the proposal, and they're interested in it and didn't raise any objections to the proposed legislation. And we've also had discussions with the high-tech industry, and the feedback we got from the high-tech industry that was important to them was to make it clear, and that's the purpose for the -1 amendments, was make it clear that this is an additional tool for a step for utilizing the strategic investment program, not a replacement for the existing structure. So the -1 amendments make it very clear that you can still, a jurisdiction can still utilize the existing method for establishing an SIP with an individual employer and going through a negotiation hearing process. The SIP zone proposal then is an addition to that, and you could have local choice to establish a zone up front.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Have a question? Senator Speaker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'm trying to think through, and first I should say that the City of Gresham, I've just been incredibly impressed with the City of Gresham and the work that y'all are doing. And it's not a tip to, but it just, we pride ourselves out in Washington County on professional, you know, forethought in terms of economic development. And I really do see the City of Gresham is doing what we think has been effective on the west side. I'm trying to envision what these zones would look like. I see the traded sector on line 13 of the amendment that it does say benefits traded sector firms. I don't know if we have a state definition of what traded sector firms would be, but I'm trying to just think of this zone and the type of businesses you're hoping to recruit and would be interested to see that they do meet some definition of traded sector. And I don't know offhand if it's been defined in statute.
Mr. Chair, Senator Deckert, maybe John might be able to talk a little bit more about some of the thought that we have related to the target industries for spring water. Before he does that, I will say that our intent with the proposed legislation is to retain the initial target for the SIP. We didn't want to change the overall structure of the strategic investment program. It has been successful in Oregon, and I believe the traded sector term is an existing term within within the statute.
So just on that, so all the criteria that we have in the existing SIP program, which obviously has been incredibly successful, would be retained in the zone. So whether it's the 100 million limit and all of that, it would be identical. It would just be a zone rather than a specific company.
That's correct.
Correct.
Cool. Any questions?
I think what we'll do is thank you for your testimony.
Thank you very much. And for the presentation. The only thing I would say is when you work on your PowerPoint presentation again, I noticed as you laid the map out, there was an oversight, I'm sure, on your part that you will correct, and that is the city of Damascus was not articulated there. All the other cities were, and we certainly do not want to hear from our good friends in Damascus that they have not yet been recognized.
Yes, sir. I'm the consulting planner for Damascus, and I'll make sure that happens.
All the more reason to get that done.
This is we've talked about these programs before and their impact, as Senator Deckert and Senator Starr know in their area, and you know they have significant impact, but also ramifications. And I think what I'd like to do is we'll hold on to this bill for a little bit until we get back to Salem and talk about it further. So I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 879 and open public hearings on, well, they're both from Senator Starr, so I think what we'll do is we'll open public hearings on Senate Bill 896 and Senate Bill 866, because I believe you are the testimony.
I am.
Senator Starr.
And I apologize that there's not a long list of individuals that are here to testify. Let me talk about 866 first. And this is a bill that has actually establishes two credits. And let me just say the genesis of this particular bill. As I think most of us leading up to legislative sessions have a lot of meetings with constituents and various folks. And I was probably just like you and had a meeting with my local Chamber of Commerce. And, you know, we're talking about, what can we do to strengthen our state's economy, grow jobs, find ways to help businesses, hire more folks, you know. We've had some positive job news in Oregon, but we still are number two or three in the nation in unemployment. And this particular bill, Senate Bill 866, is a direct result of those conversations with my Hillsborough Chamber of Commerce. It creates two credits, one for basically expansion of employment for employers, and another one is a credit for health insurance premiums. Currently, health insurance premiums are a tax-deductible expense, but this would go a step farther and create it as a credit. And the first part of the bill basically establishes a credit for employers that hire new folks. So you're growing the economic and employment base in our communities. I understand that tax credits are a topic of discussion, yet, and that's at least at some level, is a little bit of a tough sledding in our current economic climate. And yet, I think that we need to again look at ways that we can bolster our state employment. And this was a suggestion that came out of my discussions with my chamber. You know, if it would please this committee, I'd love to have the opportunity to further pursue this in the Revenue Committee, working with Senator Deckert, members of the Revenue Committee. Maybe this isn't the best idea on how do we create incentives for employers to hire new folks. Maybe there are other ideas, and I would hope that the Revenue Committee would look at this and perhaps other ideas to accomplish that goal. So that's, in a nutshell, what Senate Bill 866 is about. The other bill, in my mind, is
fishing boat bill. Is that what this one is?
Well, it's not fishing. It's an interesting, it's another, I think, kind of a cool bill, actually. And it came out of my, and I'll pass around a diagram Senator Deckert has seen, but this is a diagram. Senate Bill 896 is a bill that would create a tax credit for employers who engage in the manufacture of water transit vessels. What we're talking about is that's a water transit vessel. There's a diagram there. What we have in Oregon is a pretty significant unused asset, and that's the shipbuilding facilities that basically have been mothballed. We don't have any. I mean, they're just sitting there, not being used. And in my conversations with some individuals in the Portland business community, we batted around an idea of having water transit as a means to move people in Oregon, in Portland. And coming out of that conversation was, well, you know, we'd have to get the boats. We'd have to create a, you know, we'd have to buy them somewhere or build them. And we came up with this idea of possibly creating a new industry in the Portland metropolitan area. Let me just talk a little bit about the boat that you have a diagram there of. It's a boat that was came out of a process that the military was trying to find ways to transport sailors quickly, or military personnel quickly, from the United States throughout the world. And they created a design contest to create high-speed craft that move equipment and supplies to the Middle East faster. And what this boat really does is it's a boat that's made out of Kevlar. It's a craft that has a blower that blows air under the boat. When you load it, it's at sea level. Once it's loaded and you turn the boat on, the boat actually rises out of the water about 3 feet. You can move on this boat. You can go 70 miles an hour without any wake because of the way that the design has been made. I think that there's an opportunity here. There's a group of individuals in the Portland area that are interested in this as a potential. I think that what we're talking about is a nudge, a little bit of an economic nudge to help to get something started here that otherwise I don't think will ever come to Oregon. In my big scheme, long-range vision of things, I'd love to see vessels like this transporting people on the Willamette and Columbia River. We have a transportation system, road system, that's highly congested. You know, we have transit between Vancouver and downtown Portland via the bus system, but those buses are sitting in very congested highways. We could move people from Vancouver to Portland in about 20 minutes in a warm, comfortable environment that's, you know, where they could read the paper and drink a Starbucks and be comfortable. Obviously, there's a lot of opportunity on the Willamette River as well. But what this particular bill does is provide the nudge to take that first step and create some incentive for folks that have private capital that want to put at risk. They'd still have to put that capital at risk, but there would be some credit there for, you know, on the tax side. So that's what this bill is about. Again, I understand there's issues as it relates to tax credits, but I've heard, you know, Senator Deckert, but for state action in various ways, I don't think this will happen. If we do this, perhaps it will happen, and it will build an economic opportunity for folks that may want to take advantage of it.
Thank you, Senator. Do you, in your discussions with folks, do you have any idea of what maybe the potential in terms of the business opportunity with this is in terms of size?
Well, I haven't had those kinds of direct discussions, and I apologize. The folks that I'm working with are out of state today and aren't here to testify. My hope is that we can arrange for them to come and testify if we can get this bill to revenue. But I think on a certain level there's a recognition that this would be beneficial to a potential use here in Oregon, but there's a market for this kind of vessels really anywhere that they already transport people via the water. Some of these vessels have been manufactured in Florida, and so there is a market, at least at a certain level. What kind of overall economic opportunity, I'm not sure that those numbers have completely been crunched.
Well, we'll hopefully have an opportunity in Senator Dickert's committee maybe for them to provide some of that information on that. That would be helpful. Thank you for bringing those for us and making those efforts. I appreciate it very much. I'm going to close the public hearings on Senate Bill 896 and 866, and both of these, as Senator Starr has mentioned, in Senate Revenue, Chairman Dickert is gathering a lot of these different credits and to kind of analyze those as a group, and I think that's wise, and I think these should have that opportunity to be part of that discussion. So I'm going to open up a work session on Senate Bill 866. Senator Starr?
I move Senate Bill 866 to the Senate Revenue Committee for review cost recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved Senate Bill 866 to the Revenue Committee with the due pass recommendation. Discussion? Objection? So moved. I'll open up a work session on Senate Bill 896.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Starr.
Move Senate Bill 896 to the Committee on Revenue with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved Senate Bill 896 to the Committee on Revenue with the due pass recommendation. Discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Becker.
Just need to do the obvious caveat. I'm very interested in all these ideas. Going into session, and this has been kind of our mantra that Representative Butler and I both, but we're rethinking that, is we weren't going to do credits this session. Now we're into the session a few months, and we've opened the door a little bit and said we want to take a look at some of the ideas, and so we're going to start doing that in about 7 to 10 days. So this is good timing, frankly, to be coming over, and we'll definitely tee these ones up. But it is obviously a competitive, tough environment where we're working closely with Ways and Means to square up the budget.
Yeah. Thank you, Senator. That's and Senator Dickert, does a great job in analyzing these impacts, and we are, I think everyone is concerned about credits, and they have to be looked at in terms of what do they provide, where Senator Starr and Senator Dickert often say, but for, can they answer that question? To see whether they rise to that level of participation. And it's interesting when we've heard about a few moments ago from the city of Gresham about their desire for traded sector businesses. And as you know, a few minutes earlier, we heard the presentation from the Department of Agriculture about considering some of these products as traded sector too. So we have to, look at all of them and see what that does for our economy, our job base, and ultimately the tax base, which is a result of that. So I appreciate that. Any objections to the motion? Okay. No order. And then finally, one last piece of business, members. We're going to go back to Senate Bill 421. Mr. Broadfoot, if you want to come forward, apparently has been on the phone with Legislative Council, and maybe we have some clarification on this, and we can get some piece of work done here. Mr. Broadfoot.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, for the record, Jared Broadfoot with PacWest Communications. I spoke with Chuck Taylor and Legislative Council. So if we can turn to page 4 of the bill, I'll explain exactly what he's done, and he said that if the Dash 2s were adopted, it would be completely fine. Everything is correct, and let me explain why. Back to line 16 on the first page of the amendment, where we're going to delete lines 5 and 6. So lines 5 and 6 would then be struck, and a new section 6 and section 7 would be replaced before that subsection 2. And as you can see, in the new section 7, there's a subsection 1, and that leftover subsection 2 from line 7 through 10 would then be pushed down and be right underneath that subsection 7 as its subsection 2. And on page 2 of the amendments, line 29, you can see in line 11, we're going to be deleting the reference to section 7 and inserting a section 8. So everything just moves down. And then lines 25 through 28 of the amendments on page 2 actually amend that subsection 2 that's currently on lines 7 through 10. So I got the assurance from Legislative Council that if it's adopted, it's fine. And obviously with the one exception of the on line 10 of the first page of the amendment, changing the word promote to provide.
Thank you. What we're going to do then, let's open our work session on Senate Bill 421, and we need to do a conceptual amendment, which we have had approved, then the amendment, and then the bill, which will then go through Ways and Means. So with that, I would entertain a motion. Let's go ahead and make a motion first.
Mr. Chair, then I would move that we conceptually amend the dash two amendments by striking promote on line 10 and inserting provide.
Okay. Senator Starr has moved a conceptual amendment to replace the word promote on line 10, in line 17, delete 4 and insert 3, provide rather than promote. Discussion on the amendment.
Yes, I will be a negative on that. I went into too many situations in which the conceptual didn't turn out to be exactly what we had thought, and just for that reason, I will be a no on it until I actually see it in writing.
That's fine. Thank you, Senator. Any other comments? Any other objections? Okay, so, Senator Scar.
Mr. Chair, then I would move the dash two amendments to Senate Bill 421 as conceptually amended.
Okay, Senator Starr has moved the dash two amendments as conceptually amended to Senate Bill 421. Further discussion?
So just for clarity, Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Decker.
Thank you. So it's just changing from promote to provide.
Yes, and Ms. Van Winkle was on the phone to call and make sure that we could do that.
I could hear her,
Any further discussion?
Again, I'll be a no. I also want to also check with DCBS. It's too bad that they weren't here to testify, and I would definitely feel more comfortable having them, getting word from them.
Absolutely. I think that discussion will continue in Ways and Means. So, yes, Mr. Brockley.
Mr. Chair and Senator Moss Anderson, I did speak with Mark Long from Building Codes Division about the conceptual amendment and about the amendments, and they were okay with the conceptual amendment and then the dash two amendments as far as, they're not taking a position, but the amendments were okay. So,
yeah, and again, because we are expecting, and as you mentioned, be a significant fiscal. The Ways and Means process will weigh that fiscal with the value of the substance, and I'm sure make the right decision. Okay, is there any other objection besides Senator Montes Anderson? Okay. The amendments are adopted.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Starr.
Move Senate Bill 421 as amended to the Ways and Means Committee with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr's moved 421. Senate Bill 421 is amended to the Ways and Means Committee with a due pass recommendation. I understand Senator Montes Anderson is a no. Any other objections? It has been moved. Committee, I want to close that work session on Senate Bill 421. I appreciate you coming here. I will say, I have a couple of individuals in the audience that I appreciate you coming out to Hood River. And for Ms. Van Winkle and Mr. Goulding's efforts in putting everything together. I will say, though, I'm very disappointed. One of the reasons we came to the high school was to engage the students in this legislative process, and I will say I'm disappointed that no one apparently at the school felt it was of value for their students to participate here. So I apologize to you folks that we didn't get their participation, but be that as it may. Thank you for coming, and with that, we are adjourned.